I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined here for a special bonus episode by none other than Jack McCallum. Jack, you're back for your second go-around because you've got a second season of your Dream Team Tapes podcast series. Season 2 is entitled The Dream Team Tapes, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. And on this season, you've teamed up with J.A. Adonde, formerly of the L.A. Times and ESPN, to break down that 2008 gold medal winning team with Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, and the rest of the crew.
I did. Thanks for having me, Ben. I needed a partner on the second season. And J.A., who I've known for years, and I'm sure you do too, he was out. I didn't realize this right in the beginning, but he had covered like 19 of Kobe's 20 seasons. J.A. was in Los Angeles, and either for the Times, L.A. Times, or ESPN. So it's been tapping into his knowledge about Kobe, you know, who obviously floats through the whole thing very dramatically, has been, I couldn't have done it without J.A. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, it's been fantastic. Listen, so far, I think you had 4 episodes out so far that I've listened to, and it's just such a great storytelling vibe to it, not only about the major personalities, and I think you link basically one person per episode. So you've got a Kobe episode, a LeBron episode, a Coach K episode, a Jerry Colangelo episode. But this is not just sort of the results of the game in their path to gold. It's really about the stories and the narrative surrounding these guys and how they all came together in 2008. It's a fascinating story because the basketball program for USA Basketball was really in a much different spot, you know, 4 to 6 years before that. And you really trace the turnaround in a lot of detail. Before we get to that, though, I did want to start with Kobe because you had a lot of interesting stories about just young Kobe, your first impressions of him as he was coming along. And I was curious, I mean, in hindsight, everybody looks back at that trade and how he slipped in the draft. And it's one of those things where it gets second guessed constantly. Was he on your radar in the mid 90s as, you know, a future Hall of Fame level player when he was coming out of high school? Or were you more in the skeptical camp of, you know, it's going to be a couple of years away, so it's understandable why he would slip? Because obviously when people do redrafts in hindsight, it's always Kobe right at the top of that draft class. And it was an incredible draft class, but at the time it was a little bit different, right?
Yeah, and, you know, if I was going to, you know, the I guess the self-serving thing for me to do would be, oh, I was sitting here going, they got it. This kid's going to be unbelievable. I wasn't. Now, the reason I was aware of Kobe, because I'm vaguely from that area. Like, I'm kind of a Philly guy. I was born south of Philly. I lived north of Philly. I worked at Philly for a while. So I, you know, knew Kobe. And when I never, you know, I didn't journey down to Lower Merion on Tuesday and Friday night to watch him play. But I would have to admit to being more, to the extent I thought about it, of a skeptic for this reason. If you go back and look at Kobe's films, he was really a tall, gangly kid who played in a league. I don't have a breakdown of whatever opponents he played against. But whenever I saw him, he was head and shoulders taller than anybody. You know, he had kind of reached his, whatever he was at, 6'6 or 6'7, by the time he was a junior or senior. And so he just looked like the skinny kid who could kind of do anything he wanted to. You know what I mean? He didn't have to do a lot of breakdown. He didn't have to back people down. When he posted up, he was bigger than his guy. So I would have to be one of those people that, you know, probably why I'm talking to you and I'm not a basketball scout. I would have been unable to calibrate how his opposition level, competition level would have calibrated to compete in the NBA. So if you would have told me he was the 13th pick, I would have gone, yeah, that's probably about right. And I would have been stupid.
Well, it's funny. People say the same thing about Zion Williamson when he's playing in South Carolina, right? He's just beating up on these little pipsqueak middle school looking kids. And next thing you know, he's leading the NBA in point paints, you know, 3 years later, and people are trying to figure out how to stop him. So that's just kind of that eternal challenge of who's going to translate and who's going to not translate. One of the themes you had around that Kobe in that episode you guys did was his idea to just completely hijack a story, right? Like, you go to LA thinking you're going to write one thing, and Kobe has some newsworthy event, and now you're writing something completely different. I really felt the same way as soon as I moved to LA in 2015, where by his last couple of years in the league, the games didn't even matter. All that mattered is whatever Kobe wanted to talk about during his post-game press conference, because he was just giving these like 20-minute long spiels about you know, the pursuit of happiness and life, and he's doing it in three different languages, and it was just this real performance art, Jack. And so I'm curious, when you went to do your first big feature on Kobe, when was that, and did you come out of it with the story you thought you were going in with, or no?
Well, my first impressions of him was I knew Shaq so much better because I had done a book with Shaq. You may recall it won the Pulitzer Prize for Literature back in Shaq's rookie Shaq Attack. It won because we spelled Shaq had a Q and we spelled attack with a Q. So I would go to LA, and teams are funny. You know, they're dominated by certain guys, and now obviously Michael is the key example. And Magic is the key example, and Larry is the key example. I never get through 5 minutes of a conversation with me without those guys coming up. So they so dominated a team. And kind of it was the same way for me and Shaq. So when I would do him early, I can't remember really doing Kobe until I think, you know, 2003, maybe when Shaq had departed or were about to. And my impression of him was exactly what you just said, and that is his intelligence. That Kobe always seemed, I mean, he was still young by then, but he had been in the league 7 years. So, but he's still only, what does that make him, 23 or so. Was this just canniness, this sort of being ahead of the game, being ahead of you, being a little bit, for want of a better word, arrogant, like thinking he was smarter than you because maybe he was. So he was a little bit, you know, intimidating is too strong a word. Kareem was the kind of guy that was intimidating to, but Kobe made it challenging. And I always, whatever happened to him, the ups and downs, I did always think it was always kind of a pleasure to deal with somebody who was really a smart kid. And sometimes that works against Kobe, right? Sometimes he tried to be too smart, too much the smartest guy in the room. But he was a smart kid, and I just never forgot that point of him from the first moment that I met him.
So I don't want you to give away all your trade secrets here, but you have an amazing interview with Phil Jackson where you've got lots of candid thoughts from Phil about Kobe. I mean, very like almost familial thoughts about Kobe in retrospect. How did you track Phil Jackson down? I remember I was on vacation in Montana a few years ago, out in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and I kind of put two and two together, and it turned out I was like, you know, fairly close to where Phil Jackson kind of hides out, you know, his famous Montana hideout. And I was like, man, this guy's got great taste in vacation spots. So I'm just picturing you pestering his email inbox, Jack, while he's out there trying to enjoy the great outdoors. And then what did you make of Phil's comments on Kobe when you look back on them?
Well, during the Jordan documentary, you know, the one that everybody in every corner of the world watched three times, and as did I, I got a whole, I always emailed Phil. I don't even know whether I have his, and he has some bizarre email, which I won't tell, but, and he would usually, I don't think I have his cell, but I would email him and he would never get right back. You know, it would always be 3 or 4 days. And he's turned down stuff. I mean, Sports Illustrated wanted me to do him a couple of years. In fact, I owe him an email right now trying to say, hey, will you do one of these Where Are They Now stories? And Phil, the last 3 years, predictably, has turned it down. But, you know, I emailed him about this, and he had gotten back to me a couple times during the Michael documentary, and we talked through email. This time, he didn't get back, and I told J.A., oh, man, I know he'd be so good on this, you know? And one day Phil calls me and says, can we do this in like 25 minutes? Because, you know, blah, blah, blah reasons. So we got a Zoom call together with J.A. And I think you probably know this a little bit. And that is the hard part usually of this stuff is getting somebody. And when you get them, you know, Phil was on Zoom so we could see him. And when you get somebody, you know right away that that's something they want to talk about. And once you have them in that space, you're kind of like, yeah, I knew Phil would be good, you know, to cut to the chase. He looks at things differently. The perspective of time gives you certain things that, you know, somebody will say something that they wouldn't have 10 years ago. Kobe is gone. It has caused all of us to have this little bit of reckoning about the guy. And Phil was fantastic. And, you know, when he was done, J.A. and I said, boy, I don't know what this has to do with the Redeem Team. I know that Phil couldn't even name the complete roster of the Redeem Team. But I said, this is an episode. And we instantly moved Kobe up, as you said, to have like a Kobe episode. And then I said, well, we got to have a LeBron episode. And then that kind of set the whole tone for the podcast.
No, it makes sense too. And you're mentioning the full roster. So here's who was on that team. I mean, it's stacked. Carlos Boozer, Jason Kidd, LeBron James, Darren Williams, Michael Redd, Dwayne Wade, Kobe Bryant, Dwight Howard, Chris Bosh, Chris Paul, Tayshaun Prince, Carmelo Anthony. Most of those guys are in their primes at that point or ascendant into their primes. You know, certainly not a lot of young, super young players on that group in 2008. And they were, I think, viewed as one of the best teams that USA Basketball probably put together in a while. And yet there were still some kind of doubts about, well, can they, you know, form? We've seen some, you know, previous USA Basketball teams really not come together as teams and let people down. And plus they're facing all of the burden of expectations and pressure because, you know, it's gold or bust and everybody kind of knows that going in. When you're looking back on that group and you led the podcast with Kobe Bryant, was he the alpha dog for that group when it was all said and done? He was a little bit older than some of those other guys like LeBron, Wade, Chris Paul. I mean, do you view him as sort of like the lead personality of that team?
Well, that was the first thing J.A. and I talked about that we have to get people to talk about. Whose team is it? It's Coach K's, and I assume we're going to talk about that later. But who's the guy? And I keep going back to the Dream Team. Sorry if I do. But the ceremonial leader of the Dream Team in 1992, without a doubt, the ceremonial guy was Magic. and Magic had that kind of, this is my team. Come on, boys. We're going to do this. We're going to go to this meeting. We're going to sit for this thing. I'm going to carry the flag out. I'm going to give the, you know, I'll be the spokesman. But the guy was Michael. You know, and people told me that in no uncertain terms. When they got on the court, it didn't matter who else was saying anything. It was Michael's team. This was a little bit more interesting. LeBron, as you mentioned, was a guy on the rise. He had come off the 2007 playoffs. Remember the 48 special? And you know, he was, it was clear it was going to be LeBron's league, but it was still Kobe's. So that Kobe-LeBron interplay is certainly the subject of podcasts to come. So episodes of our podcast to come. But to make it briefly answer your question, when Kobe came, everything changed. Because Kobe didn't come until 2007. These guys had played. They had been announced in 05. Kobe's got the case in Colorado, all kinds of other things. 2006. He still got an injury. He doesn't play with them in the World Championships. When they lose in the semifinal to Greece, and everybody's gone, oh, hell, this looks like the 2004 team that finished the bronze medal in Athens. Kobe shows up. It changes. The temperature goes up. It's not as clear as Michael, but things change when Mamba takes the court.
It was a fascinating time period in his career. Like you're mentioning, he's coming off of, you know, the biggest scandal of his entire adult life. He hasn't yet won the fourth and the fifth titles to kind of validate himself into some of these bigger historical conversations. He's probably getting nitpicked by some people still as, well, he was the second most important guy in the three-peat. Are those really, quote-unquote, his titles? And yet he's, I think, 29 years old, capable of, you know, putting up 81 in a game, you know, 60 and three quarters, all those kinds of accomplishments. And really, as you paint in the podcast, just completely uncompromising, right? And just completely obsessed with work and not super interested in having a lot of friends either, right? I mean, it seemed like there was a real personality distinction you were drawing between LeBron and Kobe. And LeBron was really, after Kobe's death, he really made a point to, I guess, tell the media areas where he felt kinship with Kobe Bryant. You know, the obsessive desire to win, the willingness to kind of like put everything to the side to focus on a mission, the joys of fatherhood. He was kind of focusing on a lot of their similarities. Whereas, to me, you're drawing a real distinction between LeBron, who likes to be surrounded by groups of people, who likes to kind of be a ringleader, who's comfortable, you know, almost with, you know, four or five people around him at all times, whereas you have Kobe, the opposite, really being a loner, correct?
Oh, no question. And part of the podcast that we talked about is not only what they had to do to coordinate on the court. Like, there is that moment, Ben, when the clock's running down. And this was, to me, this was the most interesting question that I had, that I asked everybody. This was fascinating to me. There's 10 seconds left. And you're down one, or you're down, no, let's say you're down one, you got to win. And Kobe and LeBron are out there, and you're Chris Paul, or you're Jason Kidd, or you're Darren Williams, or you're whoever. Who do you get the ball to? Do you pass it to Kobe and get the hell out of the way, go as far away as possible? Or do you maybe give it to LeBron at the elbow, let him square up, you got shooters in the corners, you're trying to keep the middle open so he can drive, or he can work to get a shot? Which one of those do you do? And I ask, I think we ask like almost everybody we could, you know, we asked that question. We didn't get LeBron for the podcast. I want to reveal that right now. We tried, but we got Carmelo. We got Chris Bosh. We got Darren Williams. We got Jason Kidd. We had Krzyzewski for an hour. And that question really fascinated me. So, without telling you the answer, what do you think the answer would be?
Well, I think if you're giving it to Kobe, it's not coming back. And I think if you don't give it to Kobe, then you might have some problems. So it's almost like he struck the fear of God into people, I feel like, at that part of his career, where one way or another, the ball is going to be in his hands.
That's a pretty good answer. That's a pretty good answer. But and one of the things that happened over the course of this time was that Kobe did change from this lone wolf during this period of time. And I think it changed him a little bit, Ben. I think he went back, and when he goes back to back in 2009 and 2010, right? 2009, 2000. Yeah, he goes back to back. You know, he really brought, I remember after that talking about Pau Gasol and what a great teammate he was. Now, in the final parts of his career, when he wasn't happy and they weren't winning, you know, Kobe kind of went a little bit back to, you know, Kobe would never get anybody's best teammate award. And his latter part of his career, you know, he certainly would not. But I think this 08, 07, 08, then winning back to back, that was like kind of a happy, the most teammate oriented Kobe. And it absolutely had something to do, had a lot to do with the Redeem team and, you know, feeding into that kind of energy of LeBron. And a really underrated guy in all these teams is Carmelo Anthony. I mean, he was never my favorite player. You know, we could always have a negative discussion about Carmelo. He is a huge factor in the history of our Olympic program.
No, USA Basketball Melo might be the best version of Melo. I mean, Syracuse Melo was pretty amazing too, but I mean, his record book impact has been phenomenal. I think it's also telling that so many of the guys from that group point back and just swear by Kobe's work ethic, you know, how he set the standard, you know, off the court, you know, during that time period as well, for like letting them know how hard you had to work to kind of, you know, get where you wanted to go. I mean, LeBron's still talking about that more than a decade later. And that's, you know, just another sign of there are different ways to lead. And Kobe's just kind of did it his way.
I saw you something I remember, Ben, sorry to cut you off, but during the Jordan thing, when Scottie Pippen, you know, even during the series and afterward made some comments, and it was hard to play with Michael. He could do 5 hours about that. But I remember Scottie grudgingly looking in the camera and saying, well, I can't put as deep as Scottie's voice. I'll tell you this. He got me in the gym. Meaning that to me was one of the great quotes of that. It was okay. Yeah, he was a pain in the ass once in a while. He beat me up. He shot too much. He blamed his teammates too much. He was a great player. Don't get me, you know, the best ever. But Scottie admitted he got me in the gym. And I think LeBron, he didn't have to get LeBron in the gym, but there is absolutely no question that he set a new standard for what you had to do. And it wasn't always admirable, but those guys, absolutely, we talking to them now, 12 years, 13 years later, they absolutely remembered that.
Yeah, it's just the maniacal aspect of the early morning workouts. I mean, even LeBron last year talking about how he was, you know, waking up basically with the sun because he had to, you know, shoot for Space Jam 2, so he had to make sure he got his workouts in before and during the shoots. I mean, you just kind of wonder if he never saw Kobe do it firsthand and whether things would have played out slightly differently on that front. Although maybe the focus so much on these guys' bodies and maintenance and all that was just a natural evolution, and Kobe happened to be kind of on the front edge of that as well. Let me ask you, when you're looking back to your first experiences with LeBron, one thing he likes to compare himself to with Kobe is both coming straight from high school. He almost wears that as a badge of honor, right? How would you compare and contrast like rookie year Kobe, rookie year LeBron, or your first experiences with LeBron as this budding mogul, this guy who's getting all sorts of attention? I mean, vastly more attention even than Kobe when he was in high school. And what was the first impression like once he's in the NBA, almost as this, you know, fully established, famous figure, you know, like well-known household name practically in a way that Kobe just wasn't his first year?
Absolutely. And there, you know, I had an early exchange with LeBron. It was my assignment to go do the first story on him. And I still remember he walks in with his cache of public relations people. I don't remember who, probably people from the Cavs as well as maybe Nike or something, and announces that we have 15 minutes for the interview and 10 minutes for the picture. And Walter Yost was the great SI photographer. He's just had a special, by the way, on ABC yesterday. Walter takes you know, Walter takes 2 hours to take his lens cap off, you know, so.
Well, he's a real artist. I mean, it's not your typical photographer.
No. And all the SI guys did that. And so the first thing that I remember, Ben, was that it was a different generation. I mean, LeBron's 2003, Kobe came in 96. So it's only 8 years, but they seemed like a different generation to me. That was like a demarcation. That's the first thing I remember. And, you know, LeBron has, I don't mean this sense of history thing. I don't mean LeBron was supposed to pay homage to Sports Illustrated, but he didn't, you know, and he didn't care. And it didn't mean anything to him. And Kobe, it was kind of like Kobe more aligned with the older generation. I just saw it as a clear demarcation with those guys. Now, so far as what they would do in the league, by the time LeBron was a senior, and SI had done this, Grant Wall had done this great story about LeBron as a high school junior. And so by then I'm paying attention to him. And I, you know, I just never saw a clearer no-miss guy than LeBron. And I just think it had something to do. He never looked – I was talking earlier about Kobe sometimes, like, looking out of control. You know, and Kobe's got a little manic thing to him. You know what I mean? When he's working to get his shot, he's doing five spin moves. And he's – LeBron, the guy's never spent 1 minute looking – out of control, or that he wasn't knowing exactly what he was doing. And that's what
What's that? He's going to retire as the all-time leading scorer, and I don't think I've ever heard a single person call him selfish once in his career, right?
This came across us. We started talking, you know, the 2003 draft, beside Darko at number two, Darko Milicic, it was Kobe at one. It was Carmelo at three. It was Bosch at four. It was Dwayne Wade at five. That's one third of the Redeem team. Chris is no longer playing. Darren Williams, who was drafted 2 years later, is out of the league due to various injuries. LeBron's still the best player. He's either the best player in the league or he's the, you know, your opinion on that would be better than mine. But we're still talking about this in 2021, that he's still dominating the game and what he has done. And the other thing, going back to my first impression of him was, well, I didn't put this in the story because it wouldn't be fair, but let's face it, we saw the possibility of things going awry. You know, the relationship between him and his boy. Oh, I'm putting, yeah, no, I don't need all these high-priced lawyers. I got Maverick. You know, he's going to take care of everything. Oh, yeah, this is going to work out. You know, he's got all his guys around him. And he never made a single misstep outside of, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach, which is, by the way, something Kobe Bryant said at his draft, at his high school announcement. I'm taking my talents to the NBA. So that wasn't even the first time we heard that expression.
No, I know. It's amazing. And you wonder, I mean, both ways are interesting. If LeBron used that phrase intentionally as a nod to Kobe, it's incredible. But if it was just like ingrained in his head from 15 years ago and he was nervous in that moment and that those are the words that came out, that's also incredible and like pretty telling about his psychology as well. You know, speaking of the decision, when you were watching the decision in 2010, did you think back to that first interview and like, huh, there's like a straight line between who he was when he came in with these people around him and his vision for how his career was going to go and this just absolute nationally televised spectacle that, you know, really changed the course of the NBA for probably the next 5-6 years afterwards? I mean, were you thinking back to that first interview when you were watching that special?
I think back to it a lot. And the reason I, you know, and somewhat in regret's too strong a word. I mean, I had retired, you know, I mean, I covered LeBron, but I guess I really wish I would have been around a little bit more to appreciate him. I mean, my last season covering the NBA in full was 2008. So I had LeBron in the 2007 NBA Finals, you know, when they got swept by the Spurs, because it was, you know, sort of Ginobili, Duncan, Tony Parker, Bruce Bowen against LeBron and, you know, me and you, you know. So I wish I would have had a chance, but Lee Jenkins, you know, took over the beat and, you know, Lee just got such great stuff out of LeBron, you know, in the same way that my guys back in the day were, you know, Michael, Magic, Larry. So there's an inkling, there's a part of me that wished I would have had more of a chance to, you know, get at the real LeBron, because I never dreamed, even back then when I was watching him in 2007, who thinks that somebody over that period of time with so much that can go wrong is still going to dominate the league the way that guy has over the last 15 years, you know, amazing.
No, the continual improvement and then just the steadiness and the consistency is spectacular. So let's go. LeBron in 2008 is 23 years old. He's probably feeling like he's the best all-around player in the world in his own mind. Whether or not he's willing to say that out loud in front of Kobe Bryant, that might be a different question. But you know, he's already ascendant. He's already established, you know, MVP-level candidate, all that kind of stuff. He goes to this team in 2008, which does have Kobe at age 29. It has some of his really close friends at similar ages to him with Dwayne Wade and Carmelo, who you've mentioned. As they were first assembling, I'm curious, what was their confidence level like, whether it's from Coach K or from the players themselves? Because if you fast forward 4 years to 2012, I remember being at that training camp for that group, and Kobe came in just with swagger on 1,000. You know, we could beat the dream team. Like, you know, Michael doesn't want to see me on the court. You know, I'm taking us against them in a series. You know, I mean, he was really trying to lean into it and kind of get the hype storm starting, and everybody was eating it up. I mean, social media was going crazy for like a week or two straight as that team was first coming together, in large part because I think of the confidence that had built up when they won in 2008. But what was it like before they won? And was there feeling out process between these main characters that we're describing?
Yeah, before I forget, in 2012, I was over in London, and I remember this assembled press conference, and I went up to Kobe, and I said something about, you know, what he said. And I agreed with Kobe, who said, what was I supposed to say? You think I'm going to say they could beat us? You know, then I wouldn't be Kobe Bryant. So one of the things J.A. and I think we're going to get to it. We haven't filmed all the episodes. We're not on film, but we haven't taped all the episodes yet. So as we're talking, we're not even sure what we're going to do about that. But obviously, one of the hypothetical things was, could they beat the dream team? But to your question, I think rather than 4 years later, I go back to 2004. You know, LeBron, Dwayne, and Carmelo were all on that semi-quickly assembled disastrous 2004 team, coached by Larry Brown, that lost to Puerto Rico by 19 in game one. So they're a product more of that, Ben. They're coming in, yeah, they're, you know, LeBron's an MVP candidate guy. Carmelo's always been confident he can score. Dwayne Wade has broken out in 2006, if you remember the finals. I mean, that was as dominant a finals performance. It's right up there with, you know, stuff that Jordan did, you know. So, but they still have that little doubt. And the international program has fallen down. And we're coming off a bronze medal. And then they lose to Greece in 2006 in the middle of this, when they don't have Kobe, but they got everybody else. And Greece ran high pick and rolls on them and made 9,000 three-pointers off of high pick and rolls, which they never defended. So in answer to your question, they are not at all coming in with dream team type of swagger. They know they're good. And then Kobe shows up in 07, you know, and they know they're even better. But there was a flicker. There was a little flicker of doubt with all the confidence they might have shown outwardly.
No, I hear you. It is funny that Kobe, you know, kind of clarified a little bit his comments about, you know, 2012 versus 92, because, you know, what else is he supposed to say? Well, I would put it back to him. Well, what else do you really think, Kobe? I mean, deep down, do you really think those guys can beat you? I mean, I wouldn't believe it for a second if he said, oh, yeah, I think we're coming in second. So is that combination of incredible self-confidence, the Mamba mentality, whatever you want to call it, and also just the charisma factor when he delivered it is just kind of stop people in their tracks because he just sounded so certain and convincing. And I do think maybe the response was bigger than he anticipated. But I put it to you. Who wins, 92 or 2012?
Well, you know, the first question you have to ask when J.A. and I started talking about this, are we going to talk about it, is, and, you know, you hate to put, first of all, well, you know, me and you are both in sports because it's not, it doesn't matter, you know, what we said. This isn't the end of the world anyway. I mean, who the hell could figure this out? We can't. But are we playing a 1992 style game when Larry Bird, thought of as one of the best three-point shooters in the world, you know, doesn't think that a three-point shot is a good shot? You know, or are we playing, in the modern game? So, let's say it's somewhere in between. The argument for the Redeem team beating the Dream team, here I'm probably giving away a podcast we haven't taped yet, but the argument for them beating them was that they came off the bench with, first of all, they were what you said, they were young, they were all in their prime. The old guy was Jason Kidd, and Jason started every game, every single game, and I think played an average of 13 minutes. He got in. He set the tone. He picked guards up like maybe not full, but he picked them up at the opposing foul line. So he set the tone. This is how we're going to play defensively. This isn't some, you know, sitting back in a zone type of thing. We're playing our ass off. He almost never took a shot. You know, he got everybody into the offense. So now he comes off, you know, who's coming off the bench? Chris Paul and Darren Williams. And Darren Williams was a hell of a player back in 2008. You know, he's one of these guys that injuries really, as it did with Chris Bosh, I mean, injuries really derailed him. And now they're coming off the bench with Dwayne Wade. So, and then they got way back on the bench. They got Michael Redd, who was a, you know, lights out shooter. They got Carlos Boozer and they got Tayshaun Prince, who's a championship caliber guy. So the Dream team was older. You know, Michael and Larry were kind of older. On the other hand, the Dream Team had, never mind the X factor of Jordan or whatever factor he is. They have Ewing, David Robinson, Karl Malone, Charles Barkley down low. That, you know, Chris Bosh is a terrific center and Dwight Howard was the starter. But that is not a inside force that's going to stop the Dream Team. So I guess I would end my analysis there.
Yeah, I would say it'd be a long night inside for the front line for 2012. And it's also worth pointing out that they weren't shooting nearly as many three-pointers in 2012 as they do today. So, I mean, yes, there's going to be that perimeter advantage and a shooting advantage for that group, but it does get distorted a little bit because, you know, we're thinking that group with their shooting in 2012 shoots it as much as everybody does now because it's modern, but it wasn't nearly as modern as it is now. And maybe the gap between 92 and 2012 is narrower than we might originally think from a stylistic perspective. Although it is amazing how many incredible shooters there were in the 80s who just never figured out that they should be shooting in much higher volume. I still don't get that one. Has that ever gnawed at you that there wasn't like one coach who just went absolutely nuts and gave everybody the green light from the three-point line and kind of pushed the whole sport forward way before it happened? Or am I forgetting someone?
The guy that was supposed to was Nelly. It was Don Nelson. You know, he lets Manute Bol shoot threes. But you go back and look, Chris Mullin. Can you imagine Mullen now if you got him open threes, you know, with a little pick or off an inbounds play or something? I mean, and Chris didn't, without looking up, I'm not sure how many threes Chris took in a season. But I remember talking to him, and it was, oh, no, you didn't take a three-point shot. You know, even Chris tried to get into a mid-range situation. And by the way, you were talking about the 2012 team. You know, the comparison we would make in a podcast would be the 08 team. And there's a big difference between the 08 and 2012 team. And that is Kevin Durant was on that 2012 team, and Kevin Durant was a bitch in international play. That guy, one of the greatest international performances I ever saw, Ben, was I was in Turkey then in 2010. Now, I was actually retired by then, but my wife and I went over there, and I covered the World Championships because why not? And I never saw – it was one of the most rabid scenes I've ever seen. They were playing Turkey, the U.S. team. And they didn't have LeBron. It was kind of between Olympics. You know, KD – I don't remember everybody that was on the team, but Lamar Odom was on that team. Iguodala was on that team. It was kind of rollish players. And, you know, that's probably – Eric Gordon was on that team. So they are going nuts. And they got a pretty good team. Turkoglu's on, you know, hey, do Turkoglu's on the team. And Kevin Durant came down and made like three cold-blooded threes. You know that line drive he has? He doesn't have the Curry arc. Just boom, boom. And like that was it. And Kevin Durant was a great player on those teams. So if you took the 12 team, which still has Kobe, versus the Dream Team, now you got another guy, you know, for that redeem team, and that could have been a factor.
No, it's definitely close. It was a fun debate at the time. It just ages better and better the further we get as these guys add to their own legends and become even, you know, more established Hall of Fame level players. One quick footnote: the guy I was thinking about with the 3-point shots, Jack, is David Robinson. I mean, I'm looking at it right now: career 100 3-point attempts. That would probably be 20 games for him in the modern era, and I think he would just be an absolute monster in today's game. Let me ask you about Coach K, because you described the scene. It's almost like, I guess, the Cardinals choosing the next Pope. Jerry Colangelo's pulling together all these brilliant basketball minds to kind of decide who's going to be the coach for this group to kind of pull USA basketball together again, you know, after the tough times you were describing earlier. What were the final, like, when push came to shove, what do you view as Coach K's qualities that kind of got him the job, that sealed the deal, that earned him, you know, kind of that spot and the huge responsibility? Like, why do you think he was chosen over, I believe, Greg Popovich was the second choice, and I'm not sure who else was in the running, but maybe you could tell us that too.
It came down to Mike or Pop. And rather than the qualities, let me say, because then if I say Mike has these, it sounds like Pop doesn't. But I'll tell you what turned the tide, in my opinion, getting it from Jerry Colangelo. And that was, as you mentioned, he convenes this meeting. It's such an important meeting that Jordan shows up. Bird comes. You know, you don't get those guys to do something, you know, that easily. Dean Smith is there. And Jerry kind of says, okay, you know, push is coming to shove. Who do you think would do the best job? Michael Jordan, who still wears North Carolina underwear, says, Mike Krzyzewski. Dean Smith, who has had a bitter, I mean, they're both classy guys, so they're not going to get down in the dirt about it. But let's face it, I'm sure over the years, Dean Smith has cussed out Mike Krzyzewski and vice versa. Dean Smith says Mike Krzyzewski. And whatever, and now Colangelo, I think, Ben, was inclined that way anyway because he had been through so much with Popovich. And when we were doing these interviews, one of the first people we interviewed was Jim Boeheim, who was an assistant on that team. And Jim said something that I was too dumb to think, and that was, oh, no, the college coaches have an advantage because there's so much build-up resentment for whatever series of reasons. If Pop would have been named, well, somewhere along the line, Kobe got pissed off at him. LeBron got pissed off at the Spurs. Pop said something about LeBron. Pop said something about Kobe. I never thought that because back in the days when they were first doing this, the Dream Team, the first team to have NBA players in the Olympics, it was, well, there's only an NBA coach can coach these guys. They're not going to do a college coach. Well, by then, you know, Mike had another 16. Mike would have coached that 92 team, by the way. He would have been the Olympic coach had not NBA players been allowed in. So Now it's 16
years. What you're basically saying is the Lakers and the Heat, they're never facing Duke in the playoffs, so they don't have to worry about the resentment factor.
Yeah, I found that surprising. And then Boeheim told us that, and then I kind of ran it by everybody we talked to, and it turned out to be a absolutely accurate supposition that Mike was a good guy, and Mike sold, I mean, could anybody sell the patriotism more than Mike? And then he got this perfect coaching staff. He gets, Chris Bosch was describing it to us. Well, he's got D'Antoni. He goes, hey, don't worry about it. We'll just outscore him. And then he's got Nate McMillan going, we got to D up. We got to play, you know. So he's got these two perfect NBA coaches who he let do their thing. Like they designed all the out-of-bounds plays. You know, because NBA players do that, NBA coaches do that 100 times a game. A college coach has, you know, three good inbounds plays, it's going to work. So he was great delegator. He was great in terms of conjuring up the patriotism. You know, he did a lot of stuff, brought a lot of Army generals in. And it sounds schmaltzy, but everybody that we had on the podcast, that's what they remembered about Krzyzewski. They may not have bought into it. They may only bought into it for two or three or four weeks, but boy, it was really effective.
Well, so Coach Popovich got his turn here recently, and of course the Olympics get delayed, so we didn't get to really see him with the full roster or the best version that he could get, and the World Cup did not go well, and you know, I think for a lot of people it was frustrating to watch just waves of players kind of back out. How would you assess Coach Pop as, you know, as a coach at this stage of his career for USA basketball? Did you feel like that was the right fit? I mean, obviously he deserved a shot and he waited his turn. And he's probably the most respected living coach or active coach, I should say, of anybody. So it made sense when they picked him, but it didn't really go according to script. You know, he didn't quite have the discipline and the systems that we really expected, you know, from a team led by him in that first tournament. And then who do you think is going to take the reins from him once, you know, he goes through this process? Because obviously, you know, he's getting up there and there's always been, you know, kind of burbling rumors about his, you know, future retirement for years now.
Yeah, well, Pop's the guy. Pop was there as an assistant. A coach... I mean, I guess this is one of the eternal arguments of sports. How much can a coach do? Larry Brown, back in 2004, he had the team that finished in the bronze, got only the bronze. And that team was hastily assembled. Like, as I mentioned before, LeBron, Carmelo, D. Wade came on. And I remember Carmelo told us, whoa, it was like all of a sudden, wait, whoa, 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 we're going to the Olympics. It seemed chaotic. Bunch of guys pulled out. There were injuries. There was a lot of stuff going on. So there was only so much that Larry Brown could do. Do I think he was the best coach for the team? No, I do not. Obviously do not. But Pop deserves the chance, earned the chance. Nobody, he, as you said, most respected coach. He'll go down as, he's not in the top five. He sure as hell is in the top 10 and is probably in the top five. But there's a sense, I think, Ben, of that same scrambling, who the hell is going to play? Never mind COVID, you know? I mean, never mind the curveball that's throwing. So one of the things I think about with the Olympic team is that rather than who's going to coach it, is that somebody's got to get in Zion Williamson's ear. And they got to say, you got to take this as a priority. You got to make it cool to be on this Olympic team. You got to set the trend like Magic Johnson did when he said, hey, man, I'm in. When LeBron, like LeBron James did in 2005 when Colangelo said, son, this is a 3-year commitment. You're here for 3 years. LeBron made it cool. Carmelo bought in. D. Wade bought in. Bosch bought in. So they need that again, no matter who's coaching. So far as who would be the coach after Pop, well, I don't know, Ben. Name somebody. Your guess is Quinn Snyder. Maybe if they win, you know, they keep playing the Utah Jazz.
The guy I'd like to see actually is Eric Spoelstra, and I'm kind of surprised. He hasn't even been an assistant yet for USA Basketball, has he?
I don't think so. And yeah,
I don't think he ever has. But I mean, if you're saying, okay, who's got the discipline, the ability to kind of put together a structure, a culture, bring, you know, random guys together on short notice, deal with, you know, if guys have to pull out, you know, set the tone defensively. I mean, he can relate to superstar level players, certainly coached a lot of them, but he's coached up kind of, you know, second, third tier talent as well. And he's an awesome in-game coach. I'm just surprised he never gets more discussion in these kinds of conversations, especially when you look at his age. You know, he could be coaching that thing for a while.
No, I agree. That's a really good point. I mean, I've had discussions about, you know, I'm no longer there full-time at SI, but just talking about Spoelstra as the coach's kind of coach. And he could – I guess he would bring in Pat Riley to give a special – a couple early – tone setting meetings, you know? let's say that way. But Spoel would probably be a really, really good choice. And I guess he would have been in there, but it seemed that Pop was so much the man in waiting. I hope he does well, but it is not an easy situation at all that he's gone into.
No, for sure. And I mean, a gold medal to cap everything would just be an incredible way, especially after the last 18 months that, you know, everybody in the NBA and USA basketball community has gone through. It would be a fantastic exit, and it would just be kind of crushing and heartbreaking for him to come to all the way the end of the road, get his shot, and then have these other factors kind of beyond his control influence, you know, how well they're able to play. Hey, as we wrap up, I mean, you know, Jerry Colangelo's, you know, fingers are all over USA basketball's turnaround. You have a couple of nice points along the way in the episode about him that I loved. First, you kind of comparing him just to this guy who's just an old school promoter, right? Able to kind of just build buzz at a moment's notice, always having kind of a quip ready to go, knows what he wants to say, what the message is publicly, doesn't care so much if it's kind of positive or negative, as long as he's being talked about. And just that being like a very important skill, whether he's like raising money for the Hall of Fame or for USA basketball, or if he's trying to, you know, make his appeal and pitches to players. And the other thing that I love was Jay's story about, you know, being down in Arizona and having Jerry Colangelo basically snap his fingers, get them like this fancy, you know, private suite at a baseball game, fully loaded with beer and food, just because he's kind of the godfather down there in Arizona. I was curious, if we put these ideas together, and we know he's one of the very most influential people in basketball and has been for a really, really long time. When you hear some of these names of guys who get snubbed repeatedly in the Hall of Fame conversation, I think the one that's going around right now is Chris Webber, but there's been other guys where it just seems like they can't get in. Does some part of your mind go to like, well, why isn't Jerry letting this happen? Or couldn't Jerry just snap his fingers and a guy like Chris Webber is going to be in, no questions asked? I mean, is it that straight of a line, or is that oversimplifying things? Because this guy's been, I think, chairman of the Hall of Fame now for more than 10 years, right?
Oh, yeah. No, the Hall of Fame kind of renaissance, at least from a financial standpoint, and considering I get fundraising letters from them once a month, is Jerry. Now, I will say this, Ben. I don't think you're supposed to admit when you're a Hall of Fame voter, but what are they going to do, arrest me? So I've had 3 years, not all that recent. I don't even remember the last time. But not all that long ago. So I've been in the room. I've been in the room as a Hall of Fame voter, and Jerry is there as both. I'm trying to think if he was a voter. I can't remember whether he was voting or not, because it's a bunch of guys around a table. And I do remember when Kevin Johnson came up. This is his guy with the Suns. And Jerry spoke for him. And Kevin didn't get in. And all of us have certain prejudices. For example, one of the years that I did it, Kareem was on the committee. Once again, I'm probably getting arrested. But so we would have a discussion, and the tough ones are borderlines. I mean, you know, some of the ones this year, Ben Wallace, Tim Hardaway, there, you know, you could argue it's not coming up as LeBron, Michael, Allen Iverson, let's get out of here and have lunch. So, we would talk, and I, at the end of it, I would just go, Kareem, what do you think? And that was my prejudice. If Kareem was a thumbs up, like, you know, the Roman Emperor, okay, I'm going with Kareem. So Could some people be influenced maybe by Jerry? I suppose. But I'm telling you, Ben, I did not see it. And KJ's still not in, right? I don't think Kevin Johnson is in the Hall of Fame. So I think it is a little bit oversimplified to say one man could do it.
Now, that's fascinating. I know very little about the Hall of Fame basketball voting, because in baseball, it's such a big deal. People publish their ballots, and, you know, there's just these month-long conversations about each candidate and do they deserve to be in or not. It does feel like a little bit more of a secretive process. So that was all new to me. That's pretty awesome.
And there's another level of committee after us. I've only been on the first one. And you winnow down the names, and then I guess it goes to the super secret probation, double secret probation voters. I have not been on that. So you're talking about a process that I don't know exactly, but they did like to keep it, you know, a little bit more secret than they do. Like you said, it sounds like they're picking the Pope. The baseball guys start out for like a year. But you know what? I saw a great essay that Tom Verducci, a friend of mine, immortal baseball writer, did this essay on, you know, his choices this year for the Hall of Fame, and he made them public. And you realize, man, with most of these guys, it is a very subjective standard. It is really, really, really difficult. Like you said, Chris Webber being obvious. I don't know. To me, I would vote Chris Webber in, but I don't think it's incredibly obvious. There's other guys probably, I think, maybe more obvious on this list, but it's not easy. Yeah,
well, let me clarify. I guess I don't know if I was saying obvious or just he's one of these guys who's the held up as the eternal snub, right? Because it's happened multiple times. And so now the conversation becomes, well, why isn't Chris Webber getting in? And so everybody's like staring and all the conversation is going around there. I think, yeah, he's actually pretty borderline from this year's group. I'm just going to read you the seven names. Tell me who you would give thumbs up to, and don't copy Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's homework, okay? Just give me your own thumbs up.
Strangely, he's not in my office right now, which is...
we got Chris Bosh, Paul Pierce, Tim Hardaway, Ben Wallace, Chris Webber, Michael Cooper, Marquez Johnson. Was there a number you guys would shoot for? Because that's seven. I mean, are you trying to keep it to like 3 to 5? Are you trying to keep it, or does that kind of a thing not come in? And then which of those guys would you say should be in this year?
So there was a big announcement in the beginning. No, you're not supposed to do that. You think a guy's in, he's in. You think a guy doesn't deserve to be in, it doesn't matter if we're picking nobody else. No, he ain't going in. However, comma, as I always say, there's a human element. And inside of my head every year, I thought it would have been terrible if you went out of a room with either everybody in or nobody in. So did I, the years I was involved, would I think to myself, would I compare one guy against another guy going in that year, which you're probably not supposed to do? There's a human element to this thing. So this year, are you asking me what I think this year or what?
Yeah, just quick takes. I mean, I don't need full breakdowns, but, like Chris Bosh, up or down?
Well, I'm going up on Chris because one of the things that I always looked at was all-star games. Okay, he was in the Eastern Conference, but it's still, you know, what kind of value are you put on the all-star game? Not how you play in it, because who the hell cares about that, but whether or not you make it. Chris Bosh was an 11-time all-star, so I say yes to Chris Bosh.
Yeah, me too. I think, is Paul Pierce the most obvious pick from this group? I think he's clearly up, correct?
Yeah, I think Paul Pierce. He was one of those guys, Ben. I almost was doing a story about this when I was still writing. Paul Pierce was one of these guys that as I would go around the league, you know, you talk to guys who they'd want to add, like it's March, we want to add somebody, we're coming to Pierce always came up. You know, like, oh, I just wish we had Paul Pierce. May have been a pain in the ass over the season, but he's a killer. You know, Paul Pierce is a killer. And I looked at, you know, moving on, I looked at Timmy Hardaway the same way. And Stan Van Gundy, I would also pay a lot of attention to what his own coaches would say and try to you know, gauge what is his coach really saying. And Van Gundy said, man, you know, Mitch Richmond and Chris Mullin, and yeah, okay, but Tim Hardaway was our engine. And I thought, you know, not just a killer crossover, but I thought that Hardaway should be a Hall of Famer. And the final one I would add would be Chris Webber, because you get into these things and it sort of becomes the NBA Hall of Fame. And you kind of, it's not supposed to be that way. You should factor in college a little bit. And because of the influence of those guys and the fact that, you know, they got to two straight national finals, even if Chris called a timeout, he shouldn't have. That's not his whole career. His numbers are amazing. He was a high post guy, you know, skillful passer who wanted to pass. So you could have some negatives about him, but I would put Chris Webber in this year.
Yeah, I mean, the influence thing is a great thing in his factor. And you just wonder if he never calls a timeout, is he already in? You know, is that entire era looked at differently? Or maybe if there wasn't the scandal that came. But, you know, if they come along 15 or 20 years later, is that still viewed as the same type of scandal? Probably not. I think the trickiest part with Chris Webber is that the talent was so extraordinary that there was always a factor of like, well, maybe is he just like slightly disappointing? He's not living up to every single thing that he possibly could have been. And there were some near misses with his, you know, playoff chances at various stages of his career. But, you know, ultimately, I think you can be a Hall of Famer and still be slightly disappointing. Those things shouldn't be mutually exclusive. So I think I would go up on him. So my last question for you, though, you're down on Ben Wallace.
I'm going to get in trouble because somebody's going to, hey, you're one of these guys that don't understand defense. And I just have trouble with somebody that scored 5 points a game. I just have a little trouble. And when you're pre-gaming, I also, you know, think about how, and it's going to come to the next guy too, Michael Cooper. How much is that team talking about him? And obviously you got to keep, you know, you don't want your guy isolating on Ben Wallace or he's going to kill you. But I just don't think he comes up in conversation. And if somebody said, you're crazy, he should be in, I'd say, hey, your opinion, go for it. I'm not going to stand up and wave a flag that Ben Wallace shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame, but I probably wouldn't vote for him.
Yeah, and I feel like it was a shorter reign of excellence for him too, right? Like he was really solid, but he took a while to kind of get going. And then they had that great run in Detroit where it was like conference finals every single year. He's defensive player of the year, all defense for, you know, like half a decade. And then it was a pretty quick, you know, ramp back down for him. And I don't know, I like the durability, the longevity factor. So for a guy like Bosch, even though his career got cut short, the fact that he made 11 All-Star games, to me, that puts him into that no-brainer category. Maybe Wallace, it was just kind of a shorter run for him.
Yeah.
What about the last two?
Michael Cooper. Cooper was great. I mean, I covered them during the – he was a great go-to guy for quotes. Now, that should not be a reason that he's in the Hall of Fame. And somebody would say, well, it's not Coop's fault that he was only the sixth best player on the team when they got Kareem and Magic and Byron Scott and James and whoever else. And I would say, yeah, but if they didn't have them, would Michael Cooper be the number one or number two option? And, you know, my answer to that would probably be no. And as much as I like Coop, and by the way, Coop is the reason you know, Kobe went to the Lakers. He was the guy that Jerry West assigned to guard Kobe in this legendary pre-draft one-on-one game. Now, Coop is 40 by then, but he's still in great shape. And he just, it was, you know, 100-0. You know, Kobe destroyed him. And okay, Coop's 40. But Jerry West's eye was able to say, hey, he still ate up somebody who used to guard Larry Bird during the finals. So, and Marcus Johnson, finally, you know, really good player. I measured him up against Sidney Moncrief, who took years, a couple votes to get into the Hall of Fame. I don't think he was as good a player as Sidney, certainly not that kind of lockdown defender. So I would probably give a reluctant no to Marcus Johnson also.
Yeah, and he got caught up a little bit too with some injury issues that shortened his reign of dominance. And
no question.
I mean, that's tough, but I do think when we're saying fame, when I think fame, you know, it's like those kinds of things really do matter because it totally changes a player's story. Well, Jack, I appreciate the many trips down memory lane with this podcast. Lots of awesome stories. And I encourage everybody to check out the Dream Team tapes, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. I'm looking forward to what you've got next in the series. The first four episodes were all a treat. I learned a bunch along the way. So I thank you for joining us here on Open Floor.
Ben, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my six decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.